I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. We have the first in a series of animal cams for you, watching animals hour to hour. Tell your friends, family, and students on our website anytime that you want to see it. It is up there right now at WNPR.org. Search for the Faith Middleton Show at our site, WNPR.org, to see Golden Retriever Mom Puppy Cam. These dogs that you're going to see are being trained in Torrington, Connecticut for people with all kinds of disabilities. But you see these brand new puppies and the mom retriever. All right, can't wait to get started with this conversation. Scanning the brains of dogs in an MRI? Well, they did it, and we have the results in this hour. Why would you put dogs unsedated in a thunderously noisy MRI machine that's usually typical for humans? Well, how could you convince them, dogs, in the first place? But we're going to get to that. A team of scientists were asking this question: do dogs love us the way we love them? Our guest, neuroscientist Dr. Greg Burns and his associates, wanted to watch dog brains in action to see if they're like us, with a range of feelings, thoughts, perceptions beyond chase the rabbit or give me bacon now. It took remarkable training, effort, and ingenious thinking to pull this off with live dogs, but it has been done. The exciting news is that dogs are like us. It shows up right there watching the brain live on an MRI. Dr. Gregory Burns is a distinguished professor, he likes to be called Greg, of neuroeconomics at Emory University. His new book about his findings is called How Dogs Love Us. A neuroscientist and his adopted dog decode the canine brain. Welcome to the show, Greg. Why did this question about doing this just pop into your head? How'd that happen?
Well, I mean, it actually got started when one of my favorite dogs, who was a pug named Newton, passed away at the ripe old age of 14 or so. And that was a couple of years ago. And, I guess I've always been a dog person. Mm-hmm. And I guess I really loved that dog. And after he was gone, I wondered whether he had anything like the same feelings I had for him. And that's kind of how it started.
So this is a very tricky idea. What happened when you mentioned this to your colleagues, maybe to administrators? We want to bring dogs into this sterile atmosphere, and although on the floor not so sterile, but we want to bring dogs in here and scan their brains, and somehow we're going to figure out how to do this. What was the reaction?
Well, I guess the more generous people just laughed at it.
You had some people on your team who said, cool.
I think initially those people who said cool were just humoring me because nobody thought that this would work. And, I mean, I'd spent my whole career studying the human brain with MRI, and so it seemed kind of obvious to me at that point, well, why can't we try and do the same thing with dogs? And you start asking around, and people just assume that dogs can't do this kind of thing because you have to hold completely still. And as you said, it's not really a very pleasant environment, you know, certainly not for people.
So we're going to come do a little thing here, because I think it's terrible to make people sit here and, you know, wait to see what the findings were. So I want to, and then we'll backtrack about how this was done. Let's just say in a minute you're going to hear how you developed the system, got these dogs to sit still inside an MRI. When you looked at these first usable scans, what did you see?
Well, to see if this thing actually worked, I mean, we had to start with the simplest thing we could think of. And, you know, so everyone knows that dogs like food. So we started with food, and we trained the dogs with hand signals. So one hand signal meant you're going to get a piece of hot dog, and then another hand signal meant no hot dog. And so this was just to convince ourselves that the technique would work. And so we did that, and we looked at the activity in the dogs' brains, and my dog was actually the first to these two hand signals, and we saw activity in what's called the reward center of their brain, not to the hot dogs. I mean, that wouldn't be very exciting. It was a little more exciting to see that it reacted to the hand signal.
And what does that mean?
It means that it's proof that they recognize the meaning of the hand signals, that somehow the value of the food transferred to that, and that we see activity in parts of the brain that we can interpret, because it's the same part of the brain that really all mammals have, and many other animals too. And so it gave us confidence that we were on to something and that we could begin to move on to do more interesting and complicated experiments.
Yeah. And just to pause for a moment, did somebody ask the question, is this just conditioning? This is a dog who knows this means this, and so how does that translate into anything important?
Yeah, so I get that all the time, and you know, we thought about that too, because the original experiment was pretty much the same as what Pavlov did, except you know, we used hand signals and not, you know, ringing the dinner bell. And the way to sort that out is where we are right now, which is we start to break down the elements and say, okay, well, how much of that is due to just simple Pavlovian conditioning, and how much of it is due to what we would call social reward, the fact that there's a person there, the dog's human, or even replacing the human with an inanimate device giving signals. And we've done all of that now.
So let's talk about the next set of tests that you know, were much more interesting in terms of results.
Yes. So after we were convinced that this whole thing would work, then immediately what we did was we started recruiting more volunteers, because when we started, we actually only had two dogs who could do this. And, you know, to do any kind of good science in any way, we need more subjects. So first thing we did was we put the word out in the community that we're looking for people and dogs who like to do new things and expand our cohort. And so that was the first thing. So we recruited more dogs, and people responded, and we were up to over 12 dogs that were trained. And that let us do more sophisticated experiments.
Such as
studying smell. So that was actually the next thing that we moved on to doing. So the hand signals were interesting as a proof of concept, but we didn't really learn anything terribly new there, so we did smells. We wanted to know, how do the dogs identify their own kind of household, community, pack, whatever you want to call it? Is it based on basically human versus non-human, dog versus human, or is it based on familiarity? So what we did was we collected the scents from both dogs and people and presented them to the dogs while they were in the scanner.
Mm.
And we really didn't know what we were going to get, because it wasn't clear to any of us kind of what's the main, you know, what's more important to dogs? Is it other dogs or is it humans? And what we found was quite surprising, that, again, when we look at the reward system of the brain, we really only see activity there in response to the scent of a familiar human. Not familiar dogs, and not strange dogs, but just familiar humans.
Isn't that amazing? Absolutely. So what lit up?
So it's the part of the brain called the caudate nucleus,
mm-hmm.
and that gets subdivided into smaller bits and pieces. But the important thing to know about it is that it's the part of the brain that's richest in dopamine receptors. And for this reason, most of us neuroscientists believe that this is the key structure that that links things that we like with basically the mechanisms in our brain that control our body. So usually when we see things that we like, we want to go and get it. And so this structure is kind of the key part that links the value of things to our ability to go get it.
Mm. Would you say that experiment is what led you to the answer to the question that you raised? Do dogs love us the way we love them?
Yeah, it was, actually. Because the smell experiment basically shows several things. It shows what we kind of already know, that they have a powerful sense of smell, and that they can identify those scents, because when we presented the scents to them in the scanner, the people and the dogs weren't actually there. So the dogs have a representation in their brain of the person or dog associated with the smell that somehow persists over time and space. And that not only do they have a recognition of it, but they also kind of attach emotional or at least positive values to the people in their lives.
Yeah, because we have always wondered whether dogs see us as other dogs, you know, just a different form. That you know, who's the leader of the pack? We get into all these discussions, and you're saying to me those dogs had a choice about recognition or identification, and they chose humans instead of other dogs.
Well, we didn't. I mean, there wasn't a choice there, but I mean, we can identify the, how they're representing those identities based on at least the reward response, and we only saw it to the one very special case, to the human.
Mm-hmm. And is that in any way connected to the idea that that the dog has figured out I'm likely to get a reward from a human more than I am from another dog?
Yeah, I mean, it always you can always, I think you can always make a behaviorist argument like that. Although I think it strains the credibility of it because, I mean, if the human were there at the time, like in the first experiment, I mean, yes, I would buy that argument. But in the second experiment, the humans weren't even there. It wasn't the smell of the handler. It was the smell of someone else in the household.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from dogs, and most other animals do not kind of have a long, what we would call, working memory. You know, if you present something they like and you take it away, they will typically forget about it after about 4 to 10 seconds. So I think these responses go much deeper than just Pavlovian conditioning.
Mm, that dogs have a memory about human beings.
Yeah, and why would that be so surprising?
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you have a dog, I bet you see, you're saying to yourself, well, of course. But science has been debating about all of this, and we wonder if we're anthropomorphizing, you know, making up stuff. But if you have a dog and a relationship, and especially when it's a special dog and you really can communicate with each other, you say, I know this to be true. Hey, Dr. Greg Burns, would you please stick with us because we're going to take a short break and then we're going to open the phones for people to join the conversation in just a couple of minutes, okay?
Of course.
All right, we'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Find out what we talk about on this show online anytime at WNPR.org. In fact, How Dogs Love Us by my guest, Dr. Greg Burns, who's a distinguished professor of neuroeconomics at Emory University, is right at our site. And so is our brand new animal cam featuring a golden retriever mom and her puppies. And so you can see that too right now at or anytime, WNPR.org. Just search The Faith Middleton Show and you'll come to it. Greg Burns, tell me about any other experiments you did beyond scent.
Well, we're working on a couple right now, so I can't tell you what we're finding because I don't know. But we've gone back to our original experiment to try to sort out this issue of how much of this is social reward and how much of this is just Pavlovian conditioning to food. And so what we've done now is we have several ways of delivering the hand signal. So we're comparing the response to the owner giving the signals, a stranger giving the signals, and then actually a computer giving the signals. So it's quite amazing. Our dogs have gotten so good at this that we've train them to watch computer screens, too.
Isn't that something? All right, here's our number, 203-776-9677. If you are just joining us, we know more and more people join us every 15 minutes. Let me catch you up, because we're with neuroscientist Dr. Greg Burns. He's a distinguished professor of neuroeconomics at Emory University. His book, How Dogs Love Us, based on his MRI scans of the live canine brain. You can find his book at WNPR.org. Search The Faith Middleton Show. So let's take a call, and then I want to hear exactly how you convinced these dogs, you know, what that process was like. I've read how you did it, but I would love our listeners to hear this. Molly, Faith Middleton, go ahead.
Hi. I had a question if you had thought of looking at the dog's love for cats, because I have a hunch that my dog loves my cat more than he loves me.
Well, that's a great question. Actually, you're the first person who's asked me about what the dogs think of cats. Usually the cat people say, why don't I put cats in the scanner?
It's so funny. But you know, that is a question, because we see online all these videos of, you know, the dog bonding with the elephant, and dogs and cats sleeping together, and the cat that loves a bird. It is an interesting idea, Molly, to think about how you could figure this out. How would you do that, Greg? And how would you, you know, what part of the brain would you look for?
Well, we'd look in exactly the same place. One of the great things about dogs, which makes them so special, is their social flexibility. You know, we think that they're our best friend, but, you know, many dogs, like you said, can bond to other animals. And, you know, I think they're probably the only animal that really does that. So it's entirely possible, I think, for dogs who are in the right household, the right situation, that they have indeed bonded to another animal that mm-hmm. we could study with the same technique. Probably we would use smell, because that's the easiest thing to present to the dog. So it's very feasible.
Greg, I know you started with your dog, and that might make it seem easier, but when I realized what kind of dog you had, very alert, very sharp, very movement-oriented, focused, but still, to get your dog or any other dogs sitting still in an MRI machine, you cannot move if you're going to get the right kind of brain scan. It's just like the one for humans. How did you do this?
Yeah, well, it took a fair bit of trial and error at the beginning, and one of my dogs, Callie, who's a terrier mix, was kind of the first to do this. And in retrospect, she's probably not the greatest candidate for this kind of mm-hmm. thing, because exactly like you said, she's kind of a high alert dog. And since then, we've gotten much better at the training and identifying dogs that could be good at this. So the first key is to identify dogs that are calm. So if you have an anxious dog, you know, especially dogs who have noise phobias or thunderstorm phobias, or if they freak out any time a new person or dog comes in the house, those dogs are harder to train to do this. So we have a screening now where we test dogs before we accept them into the project. And if they check out, then basically what we do is just break down the task into its component parts. So there are several pieces. They have to be able to walk up some steps onto the patient table. They have to be able to go into a tube that's the same diameter as the MRI bore. And then they have to learn to put their head in a custom fitted chin rest and hold it there. And so we just do all the pieces separately and then start adding them together.
That chin rest, imagine this. You know, sometimes you're sitting with a dog, or the dog comes over and rests its chin on your leg and you want to melt. This is what we're talking about. These dogs, you created a chin rest, I think, was it boogie board you used?
Yeah, boogie board seemed to have the right combination of softness and firmness.
Yeah, and nothing to interfere with the MRI machine, no metal.
Right.
That sounds like you would break this down, and the dog is able to suddenly go upstairs onto this patient table, then go into the tube, then handle the noise of an MRI machine, which for humans is quite a job, but you think with a dog. So can you talk about the reward system that makes them, or how you train them to do each of these steps?
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of it depends on what the dogs like. So some dogs seem particularly food-motivated, and other dogs seem motivated by play. Regardless of that, though, the noise is, I think, the most difficult part for many of the dogs. And we've taken extra care to also train them to wear earmuffs to protect their hearing, because humans have to wear earplugs. And so we have to start very gradually with this. And the way that we found that works best is in our training classes, we play the noise through a PA system, and we start low, and we always pair it with play. So we try to make the noise itself be an indicator of something fun and good about to happen. It's kind of like if you know clicker training, we're trying to make the noise like a clicker, that something fun is happening.
Hmm. And so when the dogs are, and then that noise during training time gets louder and louder?
Yes.
Until it equals what would happen inside that tube pretty much?
Exactly.
Okay. How is it that the dogs can stand wearing these earmuffs, these headphones?
Yeah, some don't like it. My dog is not particularly fond of it. That's really the only part of this that she doesn't terribly like. She tolerates it, though. You know, it's all the same. I mean, just through getting them used to it and pairing it with either food or play, so they think it's a good association.
India, let's take a call. India, Faith Middleton with Dr. Greg Burns. Go ahead.
Hi, Faith. Thanks for having me. My question relates to the relationship between humans and dogs, and I had one question I've always wondered. We have a rescue dog who came from another family who had children, and we now have that dog, and we've had him for about 2.5 years, and you were discussing earlier the relationship of humans and dogs and that they really do relate to us, and the memory, I understand, is short, but I'm wondering if, for example, that family ever showed up again one day and my dog saw them, what do you think his memory and or senses would be to those people?
That's a great question, India. Greg, you know, you mentioned that memory is short for a dog, but that they do have a sustaining memory for people. Would it work in the way India is suggesting?
Yeah, so I should probably clarify. I mean, there are different types of memory and different forms of memory that we and all animals use. So the short-term memory I was talking about is memory for events. You know, it's like when you leave the house, how long do they sit there and wait for you to come back before they go on to something else? That's probably not terribly long, but there are kind of those types of memories are very short. So the longer type, I think, get embedded based on associations with people, not so much events, and those probably have a very different pathway, and it's very likely that the original owners probably would be recognized, and it's not clear that dogs would ever forget that.
By the way, thank you, Mary and Roy, for handling the telephone calls. That is so, and thanks, India. That is so interesting. Great. Let me tell you a quick story about a friend of mine who is older and fell on the beach when we were sitting around having a picnic together. And she had her dog with her, and I had helped her rescue this dog from the island of Bonaire. And she hadn't had this dog for a very long time, but they were really getting to know each other and they had started to bond. And I could not lift my friend up. And so the only thing we could think to do, because the car was a little distance away, was for my friend, who was a little bit injured, to kind of move on the ground inch by inch toward the car. The dog, without certainly being instructed, got down on its haunches and moved with her inch by inch by inch, which took about an hour to get to the car. He wouldn't go ahead of her, and I thought, this is a rescue dog. I was convinced this dog knows we need each other, and I'm here for you. Am I anthropomorphizing? Am I projecting?
I mean, it's a great story. I don't know. But your observations are what they are. The dog could have done something else, and I think that's what fascinates me about dogs is they have free will. You know, they can do what they want, but yet they choose to be with their human, which is quite remarkable. So there has to be more to it than just food, because like you said, there was no food there. So the dogs seem to have this ability not only to know what we're doing, but I think they also have the ability to understand what our what we're thinking or what our at least our emotional needs are.
They understand. I want to say that again. They understand what we're thinking and what our emotional needs are.
Yeah. We call that theory of mind or mentalizing.
And you can see that lighting up as it does in humans in the that same part of the brain.
Well, we're working towards that.
Yeah.
That's obviously a very complicated cognitive function for any animal. So, and we, you know, neuroscientists disagree about what that looks like in humans. So we're that's why we're trying to do all of this, is to map out how the dogs accomplish that.
We have Brian on the line. Brian, I understand you train police dogs?
Yes, absolutely, I do.
So when you listening to
and
this,
thanks for getting me on so quick. I love when you talk about dogs.
Oh, me too. So, Brian, as you know, I'm with Dr. Greg Burns, and he's professor of neuroeconomics at Emory University. He's written this book, mm-hmm. How Dogs Love Us, and it's based on MRI scans of the live canine brain to see to what degree they love us, they understand us. Do they love us as much as we love them? So, from your experience, what do you think? As you're hearing this conversation.
Well, I've got so many anecdotes and stories I could go on, but there was one interesting thing I wanted to mention and about dog memories and, of course, the bond that creates that memory that you have. In particular, what we do is we raise puppies that I select for police work, and I select them on a bunch of different testing criteria. But then we spend so many hours with this puppy developing a bond and really getting to understand his unique personality. And then we transition him to a handler, and they go on to a community in need that can't afford a police dog. But what's interesting is some of these dogs develop such a bond with me that they remember me years later. They will pick me out of a crowd and totally forget about their handler and who they're with and pull towards me. Now, these are dogs that I haven't seen since they were probably 8 months old, 9 months old, sometimes a year. And I've had dogs come off of police tracks. They're actually tracking a criminal and then came across my scent and tracked over to me. And I felt terrible, but it's interesting. And it fascinates me when I see these sort of memories that the dogs have and the way that they can just bond and use that memory to relocate their handlers and their former masters, I should say.
Wow, Elliot. So, Greg Burns, someone could come in the door and say something like, well, Brian, sorry. He could come in the door and say, well, does that animal, because the dog was so young when you were first training him, see you as the quote-unquote pack leader or the mother-father figure because the dog was so young? Dr. Burns, what do you think?
As Brian was saying, it actually reminded me of something else that we're studying on exactly that line. So we now actually have a lot of ex-service dogs in our cohort. So we have mm-hmm. several dogs that were released from service dog training programs. And same issue. You know, they were often released because they bonded too intensely to their handler who was doing the training, and they didn't bond with the person they were supposed to be given to. But what's interesting is we're now seeing differences in their reward response of those dogs compared to, say, dogs like mine, who is a rescue. And we don't know if it's because of the genetics that they were bred for this or because of the very intense human handling that they have as the puppies, where some of our rescues don't. But we can see differences in the
clear.
I'm sorry?
Genetics have a clear indication of where the dog lands, especially what they're selected for. Many of the people who select service dogs and police dogs, let's say in Europe, are selecting them on their food drive, which makes training and rewarding much easier if they have a high food drive. And the same thing with toy and play drive. If they have that desire to really interact with a person, you can use that as a reward system, much like the clicker. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, now that dog recognizes with other people, let's say that the next handler isn't so great at that reward and timing and play reward with the dog as his previous handler is. Well, they can recognize that in other people that have that same quality of training. And that's what makes, I guess, what you're referring to, it's not an easy transition from one handler to the next, that the next handler can't replicate the same way he was brought up and the same cues.
Yeah, and Brian, this raises the question of certainly from human being to human being, we are different from each other, have a kind of originality about us. Is that same thing true, Greg Burns, about dogs?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, any of the dog people out there know that, especially if you've lived with more than one dog. But, I mean, we're now also tracing that to differences in brain function. We're not to the point yet where we know, like I said, how much of this is genetics and how much of this is upbringing, but, I mean, it's there in the brain.
Well, that genetics versus upbringing, dogs have a certain experience. We hear about people wanting to clone their pets so they can have the same animal again and again, and that raises this issue of whether a cloned animal is going to be the same animal if it hasn't had the same experiences. We wonder this about humans, too.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't see how it could be the same animal.
Mm. Okay. Thank you so much, Brian. Brian, would you do me a favor and hang on the line, because we want to have you on the show at a future date to talk about training dogs for police work, okay? So somebody's going to get your contact information.
Appreciate
all right.
It.
Okay,
it was
thank
great
you.
Talking to you. I'll try to listen to the rest of the show.
Oh, great, Brian. Thank you so much. And by the way, since we were talking about rescue and dogs and Brian's work with training police dogs, we want to know that right now at our, we want you to know that right now at our site, you can see our Animal Cam link to a golden retriever mom and her puppies. You can watch them together, having their experience together, and know that these dogs are being trained by an agency in Torrington, Connecticut. They're eventually going to go to homes for people with disabilities. So just like my guest, Greg Burns, they are looking for dogs who are calm. We're going to take a quick break and then back to Greg Burns, because I want to know from him what he feels he now knows for sure about dogs and their ability to think and feel. We'll be right back. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening. And to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. We have as our guest a neuroscientist Dr. Greg Burns. He's distinguished professor of neuroeconomics at Emory University. His book is How Dogs Love Us. And it's based on his MRI scans, this work's still ongoing, of the Live Canine Brain. You can find this book and a story about his work from the New York Times at our website right now, WNPR.org. Just click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. And something new, our show is now posting interesting animal cams that we find so that you can see animals in action, get rid of some stress just watching them. That's what we do. It lifts our spirits. And so that's at WNPR.org. Check out the Faith Middleton Show. Right now, you're going to see the Golden Retriever mom and her pup. So we call it the Puppy Cam. Dr. Burns, what do you feel as a result of your work so far that you know about dogs and their ability to think and feel?
Well, you mentioned at the beginning of the show this idea of whether it's all anthropomorphizing. Are we just projecting our own emotions on the dogs? And, you know, my thinking about this has changed a lot in the course of this project, and I'm convinced that they do, in fact, have many of the emotions that we attribute to them. And the reason I say that is because when you look at their brains, I mean, obviously they're smaller and they're missing kind of big parts of the frontal cortex that we have. But the parts that we know are associated with just basic emotions, like the positive emotions and the negative emotions, they're all there. And we're not studying negative emotions, but as far as the positive emotions go, we're seeing that these parts respond the same way that they do in humans. And that's proof enough for me.
Mm. This raises a question that you sort of raise in your book about whether dogs, if they're so much like us, should have more rights.
Yeah, I have said that. And that's probably the most contentious thing that I've said, because it opens up a can of worms. But the reason I say that is because dogs, like all animals in this country, are treated under the law as property. And so if something, God forbid, should happen to one of my dogs and they're subject to a wrongful death, the only recourse I would have to recover anything would be their value, which, because they're all rescues, is basically nothing, maybe $100. And I think we're getting to the point where people realize that animals are not pieces of furniture, that they're sentient beings, and that they deserve more protections and recognition and consideration under the law. And I think the more we look at their brains and we see similarities, it becomes harder and harder to deny those rights.
Mm. As you know, there are these puppy mills, and often these are dogs that these mills take and just breed litter after litter after litter, and then puppies sold to pet shops across the country. These puppies are often taken from their mothers at too young an age, and now I wonder, as a result of reading your book, what these moms must feel like when these puppies are taken away.
That's a great question. I mean, I can't even imagine studying that. I mean, it just sounds, you know, it sounds too horrible to do. But I mean, interestingly, I mean, there are laws already changing in this country against puppy mills. I believe San Diego has already enacted ordinances against selling puppy mill dogs in pet stores. So it's already happening.
Elliot Faith Middleton with Dr. Greg Burns. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My dog is 13 years old. He's 100 pounds, and occasionally he'll just start barking at nothing. Is there any evidence to suggest that dogs can become what we would call senile?
Great question. I have one of my other dogs also barks at nothing, but he also barks at everything. But that's a different problem. So I think there is most definitely some behavioral evidence that dogs start suffering cognitive decline. Although, obviously, it's difficult to test this because it's not clear what the best way to test cognitive ability is in a dog, not the same way as humans. And so this is kind of one of the offshoot areas of interest of mine is now that we have the dogs able to go on the MRI, we can actually follow the dogs as they get older and see what's changing in their brain. In fact, we already have some senior citizens in the project.
And don't we know, Dr. Burns, Elliot, by the way, great question. Don't we know, Dr. Burns, you're welcome, dogs have some of the same emotional illnesses that human beings have and are sometimes treated, in fact, with a medicine that's given to humans?
Yeah, so one of the most common ones in dogs is separation anxiety, and in severe cases, it's treated with the same antidepressants that we use in humans. This is also, I mean, bringing up all of the ideas for research that we're doing. So one of the things that we'd like to understand from this project is whether separation anxiety is being driven more by, say, a hyperactive reward system and attachment to the human, or is it being driven more by a hyperactive anxiety system?
In the dog's brain.
In the dog's brain, exactly.
In other words, wiring.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we can identify wiring in people, and can we do the same thing with dogs? There's a scene in your book where you describe, and by the way, that book is How Dogs Love Us, where you describe your own dog who, you know, you and your wife became aware that there was this ability to communicate in two directions, possibly, in a great way. And there's a scene where your dog, you say wants something. He's trying to tell us he wants something. And you both figure out that the dog wants food, and so you give him some food, and he actually seems pretty delighted that you've had that exchange.
Well, so I think one of the things that we're trying in that scene is, actually, I was interested in whether dogs cared more or less for different types of food, because in one of our original experiments, which was essentially a failed experiment, we assumed that if we gave dogs hot dogs, they'd like hot dogs a lot more than something like a vegetable, like a pea. And we did all this work, and we had to scan my dog, and her brain didn't show any difference to whether she got hot dogs or peas. And so we did these behavioral tests in my house with my wife was helping me, and it basically proved, at least with Callie, she didn't care what she ate. She would eat anything. And all that tells me for her is that she doesn't really have a discriminating palate.
Well, what I'm interested in is, does the dog know, did Callie know that she had given you a signal of something and that you picked it up? Because it's quite an uneven relationship to some extent.
Yeah, she's, like I said, she's not very discriminating about food, but she does clearly signal other wants and desires. The one I think that she's probably best at is signaling, you know, when she wants to go outside to mainly chase squirrels and other small animals, because she's a terrier. And she's quite effective at communicating that need, and she does it in ways I think that most dog owners would recognize. I mean, she uses her eyes. You know, she will look at me, and then she will look outside, and her body language by, again, you know, using her head to kind of point where she wants to go and what she wants me to do.
So one of our staff members has a truffle hunting dog. It's called, from Italy, it's called a Romagnola. And I think when that dog wants to go out, he comes with, in his mouth, with a shoe in his mouth. That's the signal, it's time to take me out, even if it's in the middle of the night. You know, I have a need to be outside right now.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, it shows, again, that dogs have free will, and that they have they have basic conceptions of, I want to do this, and, you know, I need to communicate to my human that I want to do this and not the other thing. That's pretty sophisticated reasoning if you think about it.
Yeah. You know, I once read a book on scientists who were studying crows, and they were watching that the crows were quite brilliant at using tools to do lots of things, that their relationships were quite remarkable with each other, that when one of them died, they did this kind of circle funeral-looking thing around the dead bird. I mean, it went on and on.
Yeah, crows are amazing, and I'm fascinated by that work as well. There's even been brain imaging work in crows, too. Incredibly intelligent.
Wow, isn't this great? I love this show. Sarah Faith Middleton, welcome.
Hello, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Burns, for being here. This is a question, complicated question, probably about dog memory and learning. I have a shelter dog that I adopted, and he has PTSD. And I can be very sure he has PTSD because I'm a psychotherapist who has specialized in PTSD work. And he will have a very specific trauma response to a very specific stimulus.
What is that? Is it your hand moving toward him? Or
a squeak toy.
A toy?
A squeak toy.
Always.
So if I have, you know, I adopted him and he was, you know, he was a difficult dog. And then I got a squeak toy, and I squeaked it, and he had a very specific trauma response. His tail tucked, his head tucked, his back arched. He kind of collapsed in himself, and he went off and hid for 3 hours. And I've worked very hard to rehabilitate him, and he's still, and I've had him for almost 2 years now, so he's almost 3 years old, and he still cannot tolerate the sound of a squeak toy. It will elicit the trauma response.
This is
very interesting, and it's one of my areas of interest for the dogs. This is part of anxiety. I mean, what we know about the neurobiology of PTSD in humans is that these associations actually never go away. They're essentially permanently burned into the brain, and that the most that people can do is keep them inhibited. Mm-hmm. And we know in people that when you're under stress and it weakens the ability of the frontal cortex to inhibit these responses, that's when the memories come flashing back.
Yep.
So with a dog who has much less frontal cortex and much less ability to inhibit things, it's going to be extremely difficult to rehabilitate, if not impossible, that particular association.
Mm-hmm. He responds to it in a milder way now if he hears a squeak sound.
Mm-hmm. Good.
It doesn't actually have to be a toy, but it has to be the same
frequency
and pitch.
Yeah, it sounds like you're working well at deconditioning him. Thank you so much for your call.
Well, it's a lovely memory study, and maybe you would do more work in this sometime, Dr. Burns. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Burns, this made me think about meditation and how if PTSD is permanently wired in the brain or grooved into the brain, and so your life becomes an exercise in managing it as best you can, I wonder if that's what meditation is doing. You know, we're wired to be on high alert as human beings so we don't get, I suppose, eaten by the dinosaurs. And maybe meditation is the managing of that stress response, and the idea that it would ever go away is foolhardy.
Now you're asking me things I don't know about meditation.
Yeah, this is called conversation.
Yeah. I know nothing about meditation, and I know I can't do it.
Yeah. Could you sit in the MRI like the dogs?
Oh, I have no problem with that.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you so much. Listen, before you go away, we've got 3 minutes. Okay, good. So there's a scene in your book that was so amazing to me about someone who was the person parachuting and was holding a dog. On his chest, the dog also had a parachute. Was this a soldier?
Yeah. So after after my dog Newton died, and I kind of started thinking about this whole idea. Really, the final catalyst was seeing pictures of military working dogs and what they could do. And it was this picture of a shepherd or a Malinois strapped to a paratrooper's chest as they jumped out of an airplane. And that was kind of like the final aha moment that I realized that if dogs can be trained to do that and operate in these very hostile environments, it should be a piece of cake to train them to go into an MRI. And
how many dogs so far have you done this with?
We have 25 dogs in either certified MRI dogs or in training. And of those, 13 are what we call MRI dogs.
Wow. I can't wait to hear what's next. Love your book. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. Neuroscientist Dr. Greg Burns, Distinguished Professor of Neuroeconomics at Emory University. His book, How Dogs Love Us, based on his MRI scans of the live canine brain. And as a matter of fact, they do love us, it turns out, maybe as much as we love them. If you go to our site right now, WNPR.org, and click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show, you will not only find Dr. Burns' book, a New York Times story about him, but our new animal cam. This is a golden retriever mom and her puppies, and they will be trained for people with disabilities. As always, this show is about the richness of life. Find the books, people, recipes, everything we talk about at our website. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.